Welcome, everybody, to Productivity Book Group. I'm your host and facilitator, Ray Sidney Smith.
Thanks for joining us here on the live call or on the podcast for Productivity Book Group. Today, we will be speaking about the 4-hour work week, escape 9-to-5, live anywhere, and join the new rich, expanded and updated version by Timothy Ferriss. So this book is sort of doesn't need introduction, but it's you know, one of those best-selling books that is sort of a phenom, and you know, at least Tim Ferriss is the phenom, the book is the phenomenon, and the whole premise is this idea of being able to you know, turn your life into a well-working machine so that you can go ahead and do this thing which Timothy Ferriss calls lifestyle design, basically building a life that you want. I'm going to throw it open to the floor to everybody. What were your initial thoughts about the book, whether this was your first reading or second reading of the book from the original version to the expanded and updated version? What were your original feelings about the book, you know, sort of initial feelings about the book, and where did you sort of end with it when you completed the book? What are your thoughts?
Well, of course, initially I'm thinking, you know, a 4-hour work week is a little bit of a stretch. You know, I know the old the strategy about, you know, making money while I sleep and putting things on autopilot. I think that, you know, that is taking it a little bit to a stretch. But I saw a lot of good things in there. You know, delegation, automation to the extent that you can. You know, there were some. I thought some practical ideas.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. One of the weakest points in the book is this idea of automating your life to the point of making yourself not needed in your own business, for instance.
Yeah.
So I had mixed feelings about it in terms of applicability. And when he first started off, there was an element of, okay, I get the points, but there's a limit. In spite of his explicitly calling out, you can do things with this, whether you're an employee or self-employed or in a position to simply make drastic changes and physically migrate around and do those things. There's certainly a lot of interesting possibilities for techniques to make improvements or take advantage of some of the things he suggests. I did not get to start the book early enough, so my reading was at a breakneck pace, so I think I'll actually end up going back through the book to mine it a little more. But at least for me, I don't think I will end up, if you will, quite the disciple that some of the people who've reviewed it around on the web and some of his case studies changed their entire lifestyle in some of the ways he suggests.
Agreed. I think that, you know, it's interesting to hear both camps, right? You know, this idea of lifestyle design is a great concept, and I adhere to it in many ways. But I think the basis for it, at least for me, the basis for it is somewhat flawed. And I've actually talked about this on my own podcast, ProdPod, about, you know, the 80-20 principle or the Pareto principle that he sort of founds the entire premise on. And so, you know, he talks about the 80-20 principle, but really he talks about a corollary that he's created to the 80-20 principle, because the 80-20 principle basically says that, you know, 80% of the wealth comes from 20% of the landowners. You know, this is, we're talking about, you know, Vilfredo Pareto, the Italian economist's work. And so there's sort of a co-opting of the term. So I tend to call this the 80-20 principle of productivity as opposed to just the 80-20 principle. And so, and there's another factor here, which is that, you know, for most of us, you know, or all of us talking today, and then for most of you who are probably listening to the podcast recording, are already fairly productive people, if not highly productive individuals, which means that the rate of benefit is not as compounded for a person who's highly unproductive or highly disorganized. So it becomes much more difficult to squeeze, you know, water out of a rock, so to speak, you know, when you look at this kind of you know, concept. You know, that if 80% of your productive energy, you know, is basically, you know, being wasted in a way, being able to eke out more productive compound benefits equates to a much more difficult paradigm. But on the other side, I found the book to be very useful in a lot of ways, just from, you know, looking at things from an effectiveness perspective as opposed to an efficiency perspective, even though a lot about what he talks about is efficiencies. So let's get into some of the fundamental pieces of the book. The book itself is designed in sort of four major chunks. And this book, of course, is a full rewriting of the material from the original version. And you can in some ways see that it's a full rewriting. I didn't necessarily feel like it provided me with much more value in seeing the additional pieces, but I felt like it was a pleasant read. It was an easy read, notwithstanding, you know, bite-sized chunks, that kind of thing. But the book is basically designed in four parts, and it spells the term DEAL. Definition, which is sort of defining your objectives, defining what you want, and figuring out what it is that you want. The E in DEAL is for elimination, or eliminating distractions and inefficiencies and that kinds of things in your system. And A is for automation, being able to create and outsource your life in an automated fashion. And then L is for this liberation concept, basically, you know, what he talks about, the mini retirements and creating mobility and all of that stuff. And so let's start off with the sort of defining portion of the book, defining objectives. What does he talk about in that book, and what were your feelings about his goal setting principles and his thoughts there, and maybe some of his little vignettes?
Well, his idea here, he paints an almost Babbitt-like picture of employed life as one of nose to the grindstone, 80 hours a week for most of your life, and then retire and magic happens. And he's painting that as a very bleak picture, and counterposing that with his idea of making yourself less tied time-wise and place-wise to working, and being able to take what he calls mini retirements, taking time along the way through your life to enjoy it. And there's nothing wrong with that principle. He sets the goal for that in a sort of absolutist way of, work is bad, nobody's going to have a job they enjoy, and therefore you need to minimize work. So I think there's some of his underlying philosophical base that's a little extreme and doesn't apply to people as universally as he tries to apply it, which I guess is why I in looking now, I'm watching using a summary online to kind of refresh as we're talking, and I realize that I like a bunch of the things he's saying in terms of what to do, and I certainly appreciate the concept of taking time along the way to really enjoy life, but I don't think the goal has to be as absolutist as he tends to make it.
Yeah, there's almost hyperbole in the philosophical context, and I almost believe that it's on purpose to drive people to question the material, but also so that even if someone says, "Well, I couldn't do that completely. I couldn't have a 4-hour work week," and then they drive it back and say, "Well, I could have a 20-hour work week," you know, I think that becomes a little bit less absolutist to the material, but at the same time, you're getting a benefit out of it because you're becoming much less dependent upon clocking in and clocking out. And I think that he was also, at the time of writing, positioned to understand that we had sort of a new freelancing economy, you know, an economy that wasn't necessarily tied to 9-to-5 jobs. We had more mobility. We had all of these things sort of happening, and he was capitalizing on that sentiment and, you know, the economic movement of the time. And we're still seeing the outbirth of that, you know, with so many of it. You know, we now have the freelancers union, and all these other kinds of things where we have a lot of people who are not tied to a 9-to-5 job. But I think I have to agree with you, Lee. I mean, I really enjoy what I do and I don't mind working. So, you know, like I know that I can do other things with my time, and I look forward to a time when I can completely work on my nonprofit endeavors and do those kinds of things if there ever comes a time when that is the case. But I don't think this is for everybody, and I think that there are principles within it, you know, as he positions in the book, you know, this is sort of, you know, take what you want from it. Not, you don't have to take the whole thing and eat it. And I think that I'm very much in that same camp. You know, I'm willing to pull parts of this from here, including this concept of the mini retirement, which I still, you know, even after several years of having read the book and now coming back and rereading it, I still have a little bit of, I don't know, there's a little bit of cultural pull to say, well, how would I even, you know, manifest that, considering that I really do like what I do? You know, I mean, maybe I might even say I love what I do. At the very least, I can say I'm passionate about what I do for work. And so leaving it doesn't actually sound as appealing, but at the same time, doing this mini retirement concept does somewhat speak to me. How about you, Frank?
Yeah, I would tend to agree. And I, it seems like he really went from one extreme to the other, you know, that his work life had really been nonstop, sort of on the rat on the wheel sort of thing, to almost the exact opposite. And I think it came from what selling that brain whatever supplement, that was his one big door opener, where, you know, where everything fell into place. So, you know, as I'm reading the book, I'm sort of thinking, well, you know, what if that one had not worked for him? Would we be reading the book? Would he be taking any mini vacations, anything? Or, you know, would he maybe be out on the street somewhere? So it seemed like he really kind of rolled the dice on something and in his case came up a winner. But, you know, reading between the extremes, though, I do like the idea of that mini vacation, that, you know, don't wait until retirement, sort of work those kinds of things in along the way, which we're probably already doing a lot of that, I would think. And for the people that like what they do, which I always did, I'm retired now from public education and going a different way, but I really always liked going to work, and my favorite quote was the one about that, you know, how work and play are basically the same thing, you know, the master in the art of living, you know, how his labor and his leisure are pretty much the same, and watch him and try to decide whether he's working or playing, because to him it's all the same.
Yeah, you know, one of the things I really liked in at least the deal section of the book was the way in which he talks about sort of the dream line, basically this timeline worksheet and other things that he provides, which is also available over on his blog, and I'll put links to this in the show notes. And the idea is to sort of not only develop sort of the steps of what you want and where you want to go, but it sort of outlines it in a cost perspective. It's sort of in a financial perspective, you know, how much do you need to make and all these other kinds of things. And I think that for someone who is working on the idea of becoming and living a more independent life from a 9-to-5 job, it's actually very useful. It's very useful to sort of put yourself in that perspective. And so I thought some of the tools that were actually in the book were really helpful as well.
In fairness, one of the things to remember about this book is that it was the second edition was written in 2009. And so some of the things that I look at and realize, okay, I've been doing that in some cases for more than a decade, were pretty new things when he was writing about them. So even the concept of the money calculations that you were just talking about, where he's talking about lots of money isn't necessarily richness in the way you want it if it costs, in personal and psychic terms, way too much and costs you a huge amount. In other words, makes you grossly unhappy, but you have a lot of money versus having enough money. And he's pretty careful to say enough, but really doing things that you enjoy is its own richness. And while that's not a brand new concept, to put it together in the ways he does, actually at the time probably was a bit more of a big deal idea that was new to many, many people. than it is today. And there's a bunch of the things about the techniques, like working remote. I've been working from home since well before that book was written. So to me, that doesn't seem very new, but I know lots and lots of people for whom that's still a novel idea, even today. So there's a lot I'm going to end up taking away from this on subsequent rereading. And there's other places where it's like, yeah, okay, I get it.
Agreed. I think that there's, you know, he came into this at a time when it was definitely a new, these were new concepts to people, and there's lots to take away in it. So let's move on to the elimination portion of the book, basically step two in Deal. And he brings up Pareto. He gives sort of a very, you know, eloquent discussion about the Pareto, you know, principle or Pareto's law, and then sort of starts to discuss this idea of being able to separate yourself from, you know, the work that you're doing. I'm curious about people's thoughts on this because, you know, he talks about this being sort of the end of time management, and you know, I just don't. I'm curious.
Well,
I'm curious than everyone.
So I at heart, and it's interesting. This chapter probably is the strongest one, I think. And it is certainly in the heart of what this book group is about, productivity. So while he's saying death to time management, in fact, the huge message here is focus on the stuff that's really important and that you need to do, and do, you know, check email and in batches very less frequently. And don't try to multitask, just get on with doing stuff and all of those things that are now fairly standard productivity approaches. You still have to pay attention to where your time goes, because that's part of what all of those techniques end up getting you, is more time. But obviously the don't do the stuff that's not important, do the stuff that is important, is a critical productivity step for anybody, regardless of how they come to it.
Yeah, Lee, I had exactly the same thought. It seemed like he said death to time management, and then proceeded to talk exactly about things that the time management books talk about. I guess the one thing, the important versus the not important, you know, in the Covey days, the Franklin planner, the day timer, it was, prioritize your task, A, B, C, do the important ones. And then kind of the pendulum swung, and we have David Allen that says, look, either you're going to do it or you're not. So get away from the prioritizing it, put it on the context list, and make all of your phone calls, the important ones and the non-important ones. If you're going to do it at all, go ahead and do it. And now I think that pendulum is somewhere in between, that we realize that some things are more important than other things. But, you know, for most of us, you know, there's not a lot we can, you know, we can't just dump 80% of what's on our to-do list. He talks about, you know, those unproductive clients, you know, kind of firing your clients, so to speak. And I guess at a particular level, you can do that. But if you're working, especially if you're working for someone else, you can't necessarily ignore 80% of what the boss is telling you to do. And sometimes it's handling the details and getting sort of the nitty gritty, getting that last 20% that makes all the difference. The 20% of your efforts account for 80% of your results. Well, you know, is 80% on the test good enough for you? And if the answer is no, if I'm going for 100, then maybe I do need to delve into doing somehow those other 80% of the tasks.
Yeah, the one particular thing that I liked was I liked the little insets, you know, the little vignettes that he added in for people, you know, that sort of gave suggestions about how people were sort of eliminating their the bulk of their workload, you know, through many different mechanisms. The chapter that really speaks to me within step 2, the elimination portion, is chapter 6, where he talks about the low information diet. And I think that this is something that we can all take to heart when it comes to greater productivity, which is that we are constantly trying to, you know, eat out of a fire hose. You know, our eyes are bigger than our stomach when it comes to this information that comes at us all day long. And, you know, if you pay attention to your Twitter stream all day long, you know, or your Facebook newsfeed or what have you, you know, it's just almost impossible to digest, comprehend, retain, and then, you know, recall all of that information. And so I do agree with him on this idea of sort of taking the media diet, you know, this or media fast, I think he calls it, you know, to be able to like just step away from the television and all of the screens, basically, you know, just step away from the screens for just a little while and see where – I'm not going to do it, by the way. But I can see how that could be beneficial to someone who feels overwhelmed by information overload. And at the same time, how, you know, and I've done this over the many years, is that, you know, I don't follow my Twitter stream. You know what I mean? I log into Twitter and or whatever tool I'm using and the stream is there, but I immediately switch over to lists that I've created, basically a filtered view, you know. Something else that I've done that I think is really helpful here for people to recognize is that Facebook allows you to be able to unfollow people without defriending them. So you don't have to unfriend someone in order to stop following all of the, you know, mess that they put out, you know. And, you know, I hope none of my family is listening to me, but there are certain people in my family that I don't care what they had for breakfast. And so, you know, I actually go ahead and just, you know, don't follow their posts. Because unless it's of some major importance in the world, you know, no offense, but if you had a child and you didn't tell me in some other way than Facebook, I don't feel particularly bad that I don't know that you had a child or that you got married or that some other major, you know, life event has happened in your life, you know. Although there is now this thing, you know, the Facebook official, you know, quote unquote Facebook official means that, you know, it's real because you posted it on Facebook. And, you know, I don't know. I feel like if I was important enough, I would have gotten the wedding invitation in the mail. So,
Ray, I'm hurt.
You know, it's just that you have to protect your attention. You know, your focus and attention is so important that, you know, it isn't going to be something that we should all, you know, we shouldn't all try to, you know, consume everything in front of us. So I just go ahead and I eliminate those things and I don't pay attention to them. And it cuts down on so much of it, you know. And from a GTD perspective, you know, my newsfeed, my Twitter stream, any of those kinds of things, you know, Snapchat, whatever it is, those are not inboxes. You know, I've made no commitment, you know, to receiving any of those things. So from my perspective, you know, unless I move it to my in basket, you know, I don't feel bad about not reading it, not interacting or engaging with it. And I think a little bit of, you know, giving yourself permission not to ends up being something that's very, I think, rewarding and also allows you to be able to focus your energies better.
Yeah.
And any other thoughts about?
Yeah, he makes a good point about that, in that the one side is what you just described of I don't have to pay attention to all this stuff all the time. But the other point he makes is, and the world doesn't end when you don't. And the rest of the world and the people you deal with will live through it.
You got it.
Yeah, I think here again, he kind of, you know, he kind of goes to the extreme, you know, that he never reads newspapers. He never watches the TV. He just, you know, as he's going through the airport, I think, you know, scans headlines and that's how he keeps up with the news. I think that's a little bit on the extreme end of things. But I would agree. I'm just like Ray. I've got several lists set up. I call them platinum, gold, silver, and bronze. And if you're on the platinum list, I see everything you do. Normally, when I'm in the checkout line at the grocery store, or I'm sitting in a stoplight, or I'm waiting on a train, so, you know, something like that would just spare minutes. And I think it's interesting. Some of the people that have these huge followings on Twitter, and you look at how many people they are following. And it's minuscule, you know. Maybe they're following 20 people or something like that. So they're certainly not spending any time on Twitter or Facebook.
And if they are, they're not paying attention to it in their feed, you know, or to the people who are you know, following them, you know. And I think that means it makes a heck of a difference to you in where your focus and attention is if you're paying attention to the most important things, you know. And you know, they say, you know, you can only have up to, I think it's 250 odd people, give or take, and, you know, in your life, you can only remember that many people, you know, so make that list. Who comes to mind? Who's most important to you right now? And those are the people you should be paying attention to and interacting and engaging with. And if you can't think of them, if they can't come to mind, then they're probably not worth it, you know. And it's not that they're not worthy and don't have, you know, shouldn't have self-worth and all those other things, you know, but it's just a reality of your time and energy needs to be spent on the things that are going to pay you the most benefit. So, Moving right along, he goes into the information diet, and I think he talks about some speed reading techniques and some other things, you know, that really, it's sort of a hodgepodge of different, you know, sort of concepts. But he takes us into the idea of doing some really interesting elimination techniques when it comes to email. And, you know, he talks about scheduling tools so that you don't have to spend too much back and forth time with people. What were some other items that sort of resonated with you from that section that he talked about?
Well, I did like the suggestion as far as you know, a meeting, you know, the if yes, if no kind of thing. That you know, is this time okay? If yes, great, let's meet. If not, please suggest three times that will work for you to cut back on some of the, you know, the back and forth sort of things. So I thought, yeah, that was very practical. Of course, yeah, I've read that sort of thing other places as well, but I thought that one was very doable.
Yeah, he actually referenced the tool Jot. And I don't know if anybody remembers Jot from way back in the day, but I'm not quite sure how it I'm not quite sure how it made it into this version of the book. I'm actually looking right this moment at the publication date because it says 2010, so I guess it probably was still active then. But, you know, Jot has since completely changed. I mean, it's not Jot anymore. And I loved it because, so for those who are listening and don't know what it is, you used to be able to call a toll-free number and you would be able to speak a message and then it would transcribe that information and send it wherever you wanted to, you know, by email or otherwise. And I would use it for all kinds of automations. I would, you know, have it sent it to my task list. You know, I would, you know, remember the milk. I would send it to, you know, staff and clients, you know, being able to direct voicemail messages to transcribe messages that were sent on. And I think the concept was that they were actually real live humans transcribing the messages, which made them highly accurate, and therefore you could trust
they
that.
Were. Yeah.
Yeah. So you go ahead, Frank.
Yeah. I said, originally they were. I remember that. I used to use Jot. To me, it's kind of the forerunner of Google Now. You know, I use Google Now to add things to my task list through voice. And so before that, it was Recall with the QR, you know, REQALL, I think it was. And before that was Jot. But originally they did, it was real people because the voice recognition was extremely accurate. And then it went automated and it wasn't as good. And then it sort of went by the wayside.
Yeah, I'm actually visiting Jot.com right now and it's some kind of messenger. So clearly they have, you know, the it's no longer in existence. But it was a great service. It's very similar to I Want Sandy. I don't know if anybody remembers I Want Sandy, but that is actually the thing that, so I Want Sandy was an email assistant. So you could email Sandy anything, you know, like, here goes my flight number for, you know, June 26th. And she would automatically track that information and then email it back to you when you needed it. So if your flight was, you know, flight number, you know, A247, whatever, she would automatically know what flight, you know, what airline, the time and date of the flight on that date, and she would email it back to you so that you had it at the time and date that you needed it, or remind you about things, you know, hey, I need to call Susan at, you know, 10 a.m. on Tuesday, and she'd automatically email you back at the time, you know, with the information you provided at the time. So she was really, really helpful. I really loved I Want Sandy. And then the technology went, you know, went south and it was shut down. And then there was a group of people who actually were attempting to create an open source version version of her. And the little bit of background there, is that I actually ended up creating all, I started naming my devices. And because I wanted to make sure that I knew which device I was dealing with, because I had so many computers and blah, blah, blah that I was dealing with. And that's, I Want Sandy is where I started naming all of my devices after female names that started with S. So every device in my life has, it starts with an S except for one, which is, I have a MacBook Air that I travel with, and his name is Booker. Or Book Air, MacBook Air. So I ended up calling him Booker just because it was the easiest thing to call him. But everything else starts with S. My Nexus 7 is Shiva. You know, my former one was Sabrina. My LiveScribe pen is Samantha. You know, like all of my devices have, you know, female names that start with S. But anyway, he brings up a number of different tools that I think can be useful. I thought they were that was a pretty interesting section, and he gives you some language for emails, to use, and thought that was really useful.
He did talk about sort of having a hierarchy, so to speak. Use email first, then phone, then meetings. You know, if I can do it through email, do that rather than a phone call. Responding to voicemail with email if possible. So in other words, trying to, first of all, eliminate the meeting. And secondly, just a very nice, concise email instead of trying to track down a person on the phone with all the pleasantries that a phone call always entails.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I've actually, took down all of the various tools that he talked about, and at some point I'm going to play with some of them, because I actually hadn't, used some of them, and it's been a while since I've heard about them or that kind of thing. So definitely worth looking through and just, sort of tracking some of those tools. I'll put a link to some of them in the show notes for people to try out. And so this takes us to the automation section, part three of the book, or step three. And he talks about setting up a lifestyle that makes you mobile, and sort of this concept of, outsourcing your life and getting yourself to this point of being able to work from anywhere and reducing the amount of time so that you can get out there and then making income through automated means, being able to turn your income into, a mechanistic, sort of algorithmic method. What were the things that sort of stuck out in your mind when it came to this section of the book?
There's sort of a nice work if you can get it element to some of this stuff. He's essentially suggesting you come up with a way to a product idea of some sort, outsource all of the production of it, outsource as much as possible of the customer service interactions, and then wait for the money to roll in. And certainly people have succeeded in doing that. He makes it sound a whole lot easier and simpler to get started than I think is true in the real world, especially these days. The fact that the tools to do what he says exist, they're probably the barriers in some senses of availability of some of those things is probably lower. But the marketplace of people doing things like that is also far more crowded. So, not unlike the other chapters, this one struck me as, okay, if you really are going to spend a bunch of time to get this working, certainly possible, not something for most of us.
Mm-hmm. Sort of a get rich quick approach, it sounded like. And one that could succeed well or fall flat on its face, and you've spent a lot of money with the various tools that you need to get up and going.
Yeah, I don't know if anybody has read the book by Chris Gilbo, The $100 Startup. I felt like there was a lot of overlap between the two materials, or potentially a lot of simpatico between the two materials. And so I think that for the person who this material may work for, that is, you have an idea, you believe there's a market for this idea, and you really want to make it work, I think then this is a supporting framework for making that happen. Without that, then it takes a lot of time and energy to come up with to do the research, to really find a niche where you can actually make inroads and capitalize on that with these kinds of businesses, especially one that is, you know, pretty much automated. Now, I think that today, more than any other time in history, you are capable of doing this. That it's not that it's easy, but that it is now much more capable of being done because the information is available to you, because everything's online, or most things are online available to be researched. And there's certainly places like Quora where you could just ask a question and lots of people can sort of come together to answer those questions for you and are readily available to do that. And the technology infrastructure is there. The web has a service almost for everything, you know. And so I think there's a lot of things that are possible here, and you don't have to spend a lot of money if you use Chris Gilboa's concept of the $100 startup. So I think there's some really good stuff in here, but I do think that a lot of people come away reading it just like you did, like you had sort of stated, Frank, which is sort of get rich quick schemey kind of feeling from it. So I think that if you step back a bit and think, okay, I'm not trying to get rich quick. I'm trying to create a stable business, and I'm going to do that through X means, then you can start to do the work of finding an idea that's going to fit, and hopefully something that you care about, you know, because why would you want to just do this just to make money? I think there needs to be some level of interest in it. Maybe I'm wrong, but I think that's important. And whether or not it's, you know, reselling a product, licensing a product, or creating your own, obviously if it's a digital product, it's much easier than if it's a physical product you have to manufacture, but it gives suggestions on that too. So I think there's a lot there in that whole thing. So I'm willing to just say read the chapter if you want. You know, read that section if you want to in step three. And I think there are a lot of really interesting things. I thought it was interesting from the perspective of hearing, you know, like I have never manufactured anything. I manufactured a product. So I was very interested in reading the revised edition because it gave a lot more information about that and how it all worked. You know what I mean? It's an area of the world that I hear, because I work with a lot of small business owners in my day job, I hear people talking about manufacturing and I have resources for them and that kind of thing, but I hadn't done it myself, you know, so it was very interesting to hear that aspect of it or those kinds of things. So moving along as we sort of close out the conversation, we have step four, which is the liberation phase and sort of decoupling yourself from the office if you so choose. And so the book does make the recognition that you should implement the deal concept if you work for someone, if you're an employee of a company, as, you know, definition, elimination, liberation, and then automation. So he does go and give you at least that much guidance. And so it would be DELA or DELA. And so this liberation concept would come technically before automation. So maybe by the time you've done this, you would have the time and energy and income now to maybe make the automation thing happen. What were your thoughts and what sort of stood out for you in the liberation section of the book?
Yeah, this to me didn't strike me as much as the elimination and automation. I kind of got into those thinking, you know, there's some meat here. There's some things that I can use. The liberation, I guess because of my background in education, you pretty much have to show up if you're going to teach the kids. You pretty much have to show up if you're going to run the school. So the work remotely, work from home, you know, just didn't really mesh with my background, really.
It really matters. Frank's point's absolutely on track. It really matters what your job content is, whether or not you can do this. For me, it resonated, but it resonated as a not a new idea. I've actually been through two geographic moves, but three physical locations where I've worked from home and, in fact, change jobs through that and work with remote teams where half or three quarters of the team I'm working with, of my coworkers, are working remotely from different locations around the country. And in fact, we work with customers that way, where in many cases, we'll be on a meeting with our customers working on some project jointly, and one or two or nobody on the call is actually in an office outside their homes or remote or in a hotel somewhere if they're on the road. So I totally get this one, and certainly if you can manage this, it can make a huge difference. I was just at a music conference a week ago, and my wife came with me not to attend, but just to be along for the ride and for us to spend time together when I wasn't in conference sessions. And she worked from the hotel room that week and was just as productive as she would have been from home.
Depending on what the job is, you know, it's feasible. And then, you know, what was it, Yahoo, with a lot of the work from home that was going on, and they began to tighten some of that up because people were working from home, but they really weren't doing a lot of work at home. And they began to realize that there does have to be some interaction between people in order for, you know, for things to happen. So it's kind of, you know, I guess a happy medium between the two.
Not everyone is temperamentally suited to do that. And it does require leadership and management to pay attention to people and understand what they're doing. But the tools to do that have been around really for more than a couple of decades now.
Yeah, similar to you, Lee, I have a remote workforce. So, you know, we are never in the physical same space. On a regular work week, certainly not me because I travel for work for most of my time. And so, you know, it's a reality that we have to do this stuff. So, you know, the idea of our staff, you know, being paid for performance as opposed to being paid for time clocked is actually very, you know, natural to me. And so, you know, I think that it really depends on the organizational culture. I think it requires the roles to be determined, you know, whether or not you do have to, you know, like teaching, you have to show up, you know, you have to be there to be able to supervise the kids, to be face-to-face with them, which is very important in an educational perspective, at least in a pedagogical perspective. And so, you know, there's a lot going on there. I think that if you're, you know, you work as a customer support service agent or something like that, that makes it a heck of a lot easier for you not to be physically in the space if it's phone and email support. But if it, you know, you being a technician where you have to physically receive people in a retail location to be able to, you know, work on their computers or work on their product of some kind, then that's not really a practical solution for you. So, you know, there's a lot going on there. But the focus that I really honed in on is chapter 14. So if you're listening to the podcast and you know, really are interested in this, the mini retirement chapter I thought was really interesting. And I thought it was really interesting in the first, you know, edition, but I think that in this most current edition it was, you know, just where I sort of focused in my entire energy, because as I said at the top of this call, I'm still not sure how this works into my own life. But as someone who is not prone to vacations, but though I know their value, I'm trying to figure out how to sort of do this in my own life. So this ended up being a very interesting chapter to me, and I think it would be to most people this idea of mini retirements, of taking time now to spend. You know, I have parents who are aging, and they're still young enough yet, and that I can enjoy, you know, doing something really fun and engaging and interesting with them, where I wouldn't have to worry about, you know, them not being physically capable of doing those things. So, you know, I'd rather do those kinds of things now than I would later in life when they may not be with me any longer. And that's the same with nieces and nephews. You know, these are sort of the formative years where doing those kinds of things with Uncle Ray would be much more fun and lively than maybe me with a cane and maybe in a mobility chair. So, you know, I want to do some of those things that sound like really exciting and fun adventures that maybe in retirement wouldn't be as practical or as enjoyable if I didn't do them now. So I am starting to make that bucket list of things and or at least reviewing my bucket list of things. I have the list, reviewing them and seeing where they might be possible today rather than deferring them to the future. So I like the little bit of the carpe diem concept that is pushed here. So as we close up the call, any final thoughts on the 4-hour work week? And, would you recommend this, and to whom would you recommend this in terms of the type of person who would maybe be best to read this? And any final thoughts on the book?
So I would recommend it pretty widely, but with the caution that, as you said, it's a little the enthusiasm for some of the things is occasionally a little over the top, but I think it's still within what the author expected and wanted, and certainly would be my recommendation to look at it with a view toward taking what makes sense and applies to your situation and using it as a thought starter and to challenge your assumptions and see how you can get closer to doing things that you want to do sooner rather than later. And certainly, as you just alluded to, Ray, it doesn't mean that there's an obvious way to make all of those things like the mini retirement happen right away. But there's certainly a lot of tools here that have potential to help you do more of what you want to do along the way, rather than just waiting for it. And those takeaways could be entirely valuable enough to make it worth reading the book, even if you don't go through quite the dramatic transformation that's kind of his highest goal for people reading the book.
I would also recommend the book. I would recommend it to anybody, but more or less to skim. It's certainly not a complete system for anybody. So somebody who's looking for a system, this isn't the book. But skim it, pick the ideas here or there, modify them for your own use. I didn't see a lot that was, terribly original. I've seen most of the things that I liked about the book I had also seen other places. I think it does get on the extreme, beginning with the title itself, The 4-Hour Workweek. I don't think any of us are ever going to be there, nor are we going to lose, 28 pounds or something in a number of hours and then gain it back. I mean, that was mind-boggling. But in between all of the extremes, I think are some legitimate things that people can take with them. It certainly is one of the hallmark books that's out there. So anyone who's into productivity, if you say, have you read The 4-Hour Workweek? Well, the answer needs to be yes, that you have.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, one of the things that I would say about the book is that it is definitely an interesting read from the perspective that you're sort of getting an insight into Timothy Ferris's mind, and he's a smart man, and he's got a lot going on. And his other books, the 4-Hour Body and the 4-Hour Chef, are also very interesting reads in the sense that they're lifestyle design books. And if my recollection is accurate, the idea is to sort of pick and choose your way through those books, as opposed to the 4-Hour Workweek, which is sort of written for you to read. Those books are sort of like a design your own adventure books. And so I would highly recommend the book. I think that, anyone who's interested in personal improvement and productivity will gain something from having read it, not necessarily that you'll implement the whole book, as Frank said, as a system or as an approach, but definitely it helps to filter the way in which you see things. And I think that by itself is a helpful perspective to be more productive in life. So with that, thank you all for this great discussion. And I have a few announcements before we close out. First and foremost, if you're a podcast listener, the callers you just heard in this episode are readers just like you. And you're more than welcome to join us here on the live call to discuss productivity books too. First, go ahead and visit productivitybookgroup.org, and you can find the details to find out what the upcoming book discussion calls are. Then you go ahead and read the book and join us here on the live call. And you can find out all of that information again at productivitybookgroup.org under upcoming books. Okay? You can go ahead and visit iTunes or whichever podcast directory you use to access Productivity Book Group and review us there. That helps to expand our readership and bring new readers and callers to the fold. So thank you. Also, our next reading selection is going to be Better Than Before, Mastering the Habits of Our Everyday Lives by Gretchen Rubin on March 26, 2016 at noon Eastern. So again, that's Better Than Before, Mastering the Habits of Our Everyday Lives by Gretchen Rubin. Finally, all podcast episodes are archived at productivitybookgroup.org. Just click on episodes. So if you missed a call and want to review it, feel free to head over there as well. We have the 2016 Financial Productivity Challenge going on. So if you're looking to get financially fit this year, go ahead and check that out on our website. Thank you everyone who joined me here on the live call. You make Productivity Book Group awesome. Stay awesome, and here's to your productive life.